War was justified when the spiritual attainments of the nation are threatened, which they always will be until individuality is brought to an end. To make war against the enemies of God was to express innocence. Making war, not love, was the proper release of passion because it did not endanger but protected the virginity of the national body. In the 1930s, Romanian fascists sang of ironclad breasts and lily-white souls. By guiding others to bloodshed, Russia's Redeemer would draw all of Russia's sexual energy to himself and guide its release. War was the only excess that Helene endorsed, a mystical communion of virginal organism and otherworldly Redeemer. True passion was fascist violence, the rising sword that was also a kneeling prayer. Everything begins in mystique and ends in politics, as the poet Charles Peguy reminds us. Helene's thought began with a contemplation of God, sex, and truth in 1916, and ended a century later as the orthodoxy of the Kremlin and the justification for war against Ukraine, the European Union, and the United States. Destruction is always easier than creation. Helene found it difficult to specify the institutional form a redeemed Russia would take, and his unsolved problems haunt Russia's leaders today. The chief of these is the durability of the Russian state. Legal institutions that permit the succession of power allow citizens to envision a future where leaders change, but states remain. Fascism, however, is about a sacred and eternal connection between the Redeemer and his people. A fascist presents institutions and laws as the corrupt barriers between leader and folk that must be circumvented or destroyed. Helene tried to design a Russian political system, but in his sketches could never get beyond this conundrum. He attempted to solve the problem semantically by treating the personality of the Redeemer as an institution. The Redeemer should be regarded as leader, Gosudar, head of state, democratic dictator, and national dictator, an assemblage of titles that recalled the fascist leaders of the 1920s and 1930s. The Redeemer would be responsible for all executive, legislative, and judiciary functions, and command the armed forces. Russia would be a centralized state with no federal units. Russia should not be a one-party state, as the fascist regimes of the 1930s had been. That was one party too many. Russia should be a zero-party state, redeemed only by a man. Parties should exist, according to Helene, only to help ritualize elections. Allowing Russians to vote in free elections, thought Helene, was like allowing embryos to choose their species. Voting with a secret ballot allowed citizens to think of themselves as individuals and thereby confirm the evil character of the world. The principle of democracy is the irresponsible human atom, and so individuality must be overcome by political habits that excite and sustain Russians' collective love for their Redeemer. Thus, we must reject the mechanical and arithmetical understanding of politics as well as blind faith in the number of votes and its political significance. Voting should unite the nation in a gesture of subjugation. Elections should be public and ballots signed. Helene imagined society as a corporate structure, where every person and every group would hold a defined place. There would be no distinction between the state and the population, but rather the organic spiritual unity of the government with the people and the people with the government. The Redeemer would stand alone at the heights, and the middle classes would lie crushed at the bottom under the weight of everyone else. In normal parlance, middle classes are in the middle because people rise and fall through them. Placing the middle classes at the bottom was to assert the righteousness of inequality. Social mobility was excluded from the outset. An idea that Helene intended as fascist thus permits and justifies oligarchy, rule by the wealthy few, as in Russia in the 2010s. If the purpose of the state is to preserve the wealth of the Redeemer and his friends, then the rule of law is impossible. Without the rule of law, it is difficult to earn the money that will allow for better lives. Without social advancement, no story of the future seems plausible. The weakness of state policy is then recast as the mystical connection of a leader with his people. Rather than governing, the leader produces crisis and spectacle. Law ceases to signify neutral norms that allow social advance and comes to mean subordination to the status quo. The right to watch, the duty to be entertained. Eline used the word law, but he did not endorse the rule of law. By law, he meant the relationship between the caprice of the Redeemer and the obedience of everyone else. Again, a fascist idea proved to be convenient for an emerging oligarchy. The loving duty of the Russian masses was to translate the Redeemer's every whim into a sense of legal obligation on their part. The obligation, of course, was not reciprocal. Russians had a special arrangement of the soul that allowed them to suppress their own reason and accept the law in our hearts. By this, Eline understood the suppression of individual reason in favor of national submission. With the Redeemer in command of such a system, Russia would exhibit the metaphysical identity of all people of the same nation. The Russian nation, summoned to instant war against spiritual threats, was a creature rendered divine by its submission to an arbitrary leader who emerged from fiction. The Redeemer would take upon himself the burden of dissolving all facts and passions, thereby rendering senseless any aspiration of any individual Russian to see or feel or change the world. Each Russian's place in the corporate structure would be fixed like a cell in a body, and each Russian would experience this immobility as freedom. Unified by their Redeemer, their sins washed away in the blood of others, Russians would welcome God back to his creation. Christian fascist totalitarianism is an invitation to God to return to the world and help Russia bring an end to history everywhere. Eline placed a human being in the role of the true Christ, required to break the laws of love in the name of God. In doing so, he blurred the line between what is human and what is not, and between what is possible and what is not. The fantasy of an eternally innocent Russia includes the fantasy of an eternally innocent Redeemer who does no wrong and therefore will not die. Eline could not answer the question of who might succeed the Redeemer, since doing so would make of the Redeemer a human subject to aging and death, no less part of the flawed universe than the rest of us. Eline had no earthly idea, in other words, of how a Russian state could endure. The very dread of what comes next generates a sense of threat that can be projected upon others as foreign policy. Totalitarianism is its own true enemy, and that is the secret it keeps from itself by attacking others. In the 2010s, Eline's ideas served post-Soviet billionaires, and post-Soviet billionaires served them. Putin and his friends and allies accumulated vast wealth beyond the law, and then remade the state to preserve their own gains. Having achieved this, Russian leaders had to define politics as being rather than doing. An ideology such as Eline's purports to explain why certain men have wealth and power in terms other than greed and ambition. What robber would not prefer to be called a redeemer? To men raised in the Soviet Union in the 1970s, Eline's ideas were comfortable for a second reason. To the Russian kleptocrats of that generation, the men in power in the 2010s, his entire style of thinking was familiar. Although Eline opposed Soviet power, the shape of his argument was eerily similar to that of the Marxism, Leninism, and Stalinism in which all Soviet citizens were educated. Although Russian kleptocrats are by no means philosophers, the instruction of their youth led them surprisingly close to the justifications they would need in their maturity. Eline and the Marxism he opposed shared a philosophical origin and language, that of Hegelianism. G. W. F. Hegel's ambition was to resolve the difference between what is and what should be. His claim was that something called spirit, a unity of all thoughts and minds, was emerging over time through the conflicts that defined epochs. Hegel's was an appealing way of seeing our fractious world, since it suggested that catastrophe was an indication of progress. History was a slaughter bench, but the bloodshed had a purpose. This idea allowed philosophers to pose as prophets, seers of hidden patterns that would resolve themselves into a better world, judges of who had to suffer now so that all would benefit later. If spirit was the only good, then any means that history chose for its realization was also good. Karl Marx was critical of Hegel's idea of spirit. He and other left Hegelians claimed that Hegel had smuggled God into his system under the heading of spirit. The absolute good, suggested Marx, was not God, but humanity's lost essence. History was a struggle, but its sense was man's overcoming of circumstance to regain his own nature. The emergence of technology, argued Marx, allowed some men to dominate others, forming social classes. Under capitalism, the bourgeoisie controlled the means of production, oppressing the mass of workers. This very oppression instructed workers about the character of history and made them revolutionaries. The proletariat would overthrow the bourgeoisie, seize the means of production, and thereby restore man to himself. Once there was no property, thought Marx, human beings would live in happy cooperation. Eline was a right Hegelian. In a typically sharp phrase, he wrote that Marx never got out of the waiting room of Hegelian philosophy. Eline nevertheless agreed that by spirit, Hegel meant God. Like Marx, Eline thought that history had begun with an original sin that doomed humanity to suffering. It was perpetrated not by man upon man through property, as the Marxists thought, but by God upon man through the creation of the world. Rather than killing God, as the left Hegelians had done, Eline left him wounded and lonely. Life was poor and chaotic, as the Marxists thought, but not because of technology and class conflict. People suffered because God's creation was irresolvably conflictual. Facts and passions could not be aligned through revolution, only through redemption. The only totality was God's, which a chosen nation would restore thanks to a miracle performed by a redeemer. Vladimir Lenin, 1870-1924, was the most important Marxist, since he led a revolution in the name of the philosophy. As an activist of a small and illegal party in the Russian Empire, Lenin believed that a disciplined elite had the right to push history forward. If the only good in the world was the restoration of man to his essence, then it was reasonable for those who understood the process to hasten it. This reasoning enabled the Bolshevik Revolution of 1917. The Soviet Union was ruled by a small group of people who claimed legitimacy from this specific politics of inevitability. Lenin and Eline did not know each other, but were uncannily close. Lenin's patronymic was Ilyich, and he used Eline as a pen name. The real Eline read and reviewed some of that work. When Eline was arrested by the Bolshevik secret police, the Cheka, Lenin intervened on his behalf in order to express his admiration of Eline's philosophy. Eline despised Lenin's revolution, but he endorsed its violence and its voluntarism. Like Lenin, he thought that Russia needed the philosophical elite, himself, to define ends and means. Like the Marxist socialist utopia, Eline's divine totality required violent revolution, or rather, violent counter-revolution. Other Russian philosophers saw the resemblance. Nikolai Berdyaev found in Eline's work The Nightmare of Evil Good. Reviewing a book that Eline published in 1925, Berdyaev wrote that a Cheka in the name of God is more horrifying than a Cheka in the name of the devil. His judgment was prophetic. The Bolsheviks would have no fundamental problem accepting Ivan Eline's book. They consider themselves the bearers of absolute good and oppose those whom they regard as evil with force. As Eline aged in Germany and Switzerland, his positions tracked those of Lenin's successors. After Lenin died in 1924, Joseph Stalin consolidated power. Eileen shared Stalinist judgments about the contagious perversity of Western culture down to the smallest detail. He believed, for instance, that jazz was a deliberate plot to reduce European listeners to mindless dancers, incapable of normal sexual intercourse. The Communist Party newspaper Pravda offered a strikingly similar description of the experience of listening to African-American music. Some centaur must be conducting with his gigantic phallus. Though Eileen wrote books chronicling terror under Stalin, his attitude to the law was essentially similar to that of its perpetrators. Andrei Vyshinsky, the notorious prosecutor at the show trials, believed that formal law is subordinate to the law of the revolution. This was precisely Eileen's attitude with respect to his planned counter-revolution. Although Eileen had initially hoped that the Second World War would destroy Stalin's Soviet Union, in its aftermath, he presented Russia much as Stalin did. Stalin called the USSR the homeland of socialism. If the Soviet Union were destroyed, went his argument, communism would have no future, and humanity's only hope would be lost. Thus, any action to defend the Soviet Union was justified. Eileen saw Russia as a homeland of God to be preserved at all costs, since it was the only territory from which divine totality could be restored. After the war, Stalin gave priority to the Russian nation, as opposed to Ukraine, Belarus, Central Asia, the Caucasus, the dozens of people of the Soviet Union. Russia, Stalin claimed, had saved the world from fascism. Eileen's view was that Russia would save the world not from, but with fascism. In both cases, the only receptacle of absolute good was Russia, and the permanent enemy, the decadent West. Soviet communism was a politics of inevitability that yielded to a politics of eternity. Over the decades, the idea of Russia as a beacon for the world gave way to the image of Russia as a victim of mindless hostility. In the beginning, Bolshevism was not a state, but a revolution, the hope that others around the world would follow the Russian example. Then it was a state with a task, to build socialism by imitating capitalism and then overcoming it. Stalinism was a vision of the future that justified millions of deaths by starvation and another million or so by execution in the 1930s. The Second World War changed the story. Stalin and his supporters and successors all claimed after 1945 that the self-inflicted carnage of the 1930s had been necessary to defeat the Germans in the 1940s. If the 1930s were about the 1940s, then they were not about a distant future of socialism. The aftermath of the Second World War was the beginning of the end of the Soviet politics of inevitability, and thus the opening gesture towards a Russian politics of eternity. Stalin's economic policy, forced industrialization, funded by collectivized agriculture, created social mobility for two generations, but not for three. In the 1950s and 1960s, Soviet leaders agreed not to kill one another, which removed dynamism from politics. In the 1970s, Leonid Brezhnev took a logical step towards a politics of eternity, portraying the Second World War as the apogee of Soviet history. Soviet citizens were instructed to look not forward but backward to the triumph of their parents or grandparents in the Second World War. The West was no longer the enemy because it represented a capitalism that would be surpassed. The West was the enemy because the Soviet Union had been invaded from the West in 1941. Soviet citizens born in the 1960s and 1970s were raised in a cult of the past that defined the West as a perpetual threat. The last decades of Soviet communism prepared Soviet citizens for Eileen's view of the world. The oligarchy that emerged in the Russian Federation after 1991 had a great deal to do with the centralization of production under communism, the ideas of Russian economists thereafter, and the greed of Russia's leaders. American conventional wisdom contributed to the disaster by suggesting that markets would create institutions rather than stressing that institutions were needed for markets. In the 21st century, it proved easier to blame the West than to take stock of Russian choices. The Russian leaders who did the blaming in the 2010s were the very individuals who stole the national wealth. those who proclaimed Ilin's ideas from the heights of the Russian state were the beneficiaries rather than the victims of capitalism's career in Russia. The men of Putin's entourage ensured that the rule of law had no chance in Russia, since they themselves created and profited from a state monopoly on corruption. Ilin's ideas sanctified radical inequality at home, changed the subject of politics from reform to innocence, while defining the West as a permanent source of a spiritual threat. No Russian state could be built on Ilin's concepts, but they did help robbers to present themselves as redeemers. They enabled new leaders to choose enemies and thus create fictional problems that could not be solved, such as the permanent hostility of a decadent West. The notion that Europe and America were eternal foes because they envied pristine Russian culture was pure fiction that generated real policy, the attempt to destroy the attainments abroad that Russia's leaders could not manage at home. The politics of eternity cannot make Putin or any other man immortal, but it can make other ideas unthinkable. And that is what eternity means. The same thing over and over again. A tedium exciting to believers because of the illusion that it is particularly theirs. Of course, this sense of us and them, or, as fascists prefer, friends and enemies, is the least specific human experience of them all. To live within it is to sacrifice individuality. The only thing that stands between inevitability and eternity is history, as considered and lived by individuals. If we grasp eternity and inevitability as ideas within our own history, we might see what has happened to us and what we might do about it. We understand totalitarianism as a threat to institutions, but also to selves. In the fury of their assault, Ilin's ideas clarify individualism as a political virtue, the one that enables all the others. Are we individuals who see that there are many good things, and that politics involves responsible consideration and choice, rather than a vision of totality? Do we see that there are other individuals in the world who might be at work on the same project? Do we understand that being an individual requires a constant consideration of endless factuality, a constant selection among many irreducible passions? The virtue of individualism becomes visible in the throes of our moment, but it will abide only if we see history and ourselves within it and accept our share of responsibility. Chapter 2. Succession or Failure, 2012. History has proven that all dictatorships, all authoritarian forms of government, are transient. Only democratic systems are intransient. Vladimir Putin, 1999. Ilin's conception of the innocent nation disguised the effort required to make a durable state. To propose that a Russian redeemer would enchant the world was to dodge the question of how he would establish political institutions. In discrediting democratic elections in 2011 and 2012, Vladimir Putin took on the mantle of the heroic redeemer and placed his country on the horns of Ilin's dilemma. No one can change Russia for the better so long as he lives, and no one in Russia knows what will happen when he dies. The fascists of Ilin's time fantasized away the problem of endurance. In 1940, the Romanian fascist Alexandru Randa proclaimed that fascist leaders transform the nation into a permanent force, into a corpus mysticus, freed from borders. The Redeemer's charisma removes the nation from history. Adolf Hitler claimed that all that mattered was the struggle of the race, and that the elimination of Jews would restore nature's eternal balance. His thousand-year Reich lasted 12 years, and he committed suicide. A state does not endure because a leader mystifies a generation. The problem of political endurance cannot be solved by people who think only of the present. Leaders must think beyond themselves and their clans, to imagine how other people might succeed them in the future. Functional states produce a sense of continuity for their citizens. If states sustain themselves, citizens can imagine change without fearing catastrophe. The mechanism that ensures that a state outlasts a leader is called the principle of succession. A common one is democracy. The meaning of each election is the promise of the next one. Since each citizen is fallible, democracy transforms cumulative mistakes into a collective belief in the future. History goes on. The Soviet Union that expelled Ilin and educated Putin had a troubled relationship with time. It lacked a succession principle and lasted only 69 years. The Bolsheviks were not concerned about succession because they believed that they were beginning a global revolution, not creating a state. The Russian Revolution of 1917 was for the world, a stroke of lightning to set civilization aflame, to start history anew. When this prophecy failed, the Bolsheviks had no choice but to establish a state on the territories they controlled, a new regime, which they called the Soviet Union. In the Soviet Union, as founded in 1922, power lay with the Communist Party. The party claimed legitimacy not from legal principle or continuity with the past, but from the glory of the revolution and bright promise of the future. In principle, all authority lay with the working class. Workers were represented by the party by its central committee, the central committee by its Politburo, and the Politburo usually by a single leading man, Lenin and later Stalin. Marxism-Leninism was a politics of inevitability. The course of events was known in advance. Socialism would displace capitalism, and party leaders knew the details and made the plans. The initial state was purpose-built to accelerate time, to replicate the industry that capitalism had created elsewhere. Once the Soviet Union had the factories and the cities, it could undo the principle of property, socialist harmony would result, and the state could fade away. Although the USSR's state-controlled agriculture and planned economy did generate a modern infrastructure, workers never gained power, and the state never vanished. Because no principle of succession was ever established, the death of each leader threatened the system as a whole. After Lenin's death in 1924, it took Stalin about 6 years to defeat his rivals, several of whom were killed. He presided over the dramatic modernization of the first five-year plan of 1928 to 1933, which built cities and factories at the price of the starvation of millions and the exile of millions more to concentration camps. Stalin was also the chief author of the Great Terror of 1937 to 1938, in which 682,691 Soviet citizens were shot, and of a smaller terror in 1939 to 1941, when Soviet borders were extended westward during the Soviet alliance with Nazi Germany. Among other episodes of mass killing and deportation, this smaller terror involved the murder of 21,892 Polish citizens at Katyn and other sites in 1940. Stalin was surprised when he was betrayed by his ally Hitler in 1941, but after the victory of the Red Army in 1945, he portrayed himself as the savior of the socialist project and the Russian nation. After the Second World War, the Soviet Union was able to establish an outer empire of replicate regimes on or near its western frontier: Poland, Romania, Hungary, Czechoslovakia, Bulgaria. It also reincorporated Estonia, Latvia, and Lithuania, the three Baltic states it initially annexed thanks to Stalin's alliance with Hitler. After Stalin's death in 1953, only one candidate for power was killed, and by the end of the 1950s, Nikita Khrushchev seemed to have consolidated power. Khrushchev, however, was superseded in 1964 by Leonid Brezhnev. It was Brezhnev who proved to be Stalin's most important successor, because he redefined the Soviet attitude to time. He buried the Marxist politics of inevitability and replaced it with a Soviet politics of eternity. The Bolshevik Revolution had been about youth, about a new start to be made after capitalism. This image depended at home and especially abroad, on the blood purges that allowed new men and women to rise through the party ranks. When these ceased in the 1960s, Soviet leaders aged along with the Soviet state. Rather than of a victory of communism to come, Brezhnev spoke in the 1970s of really existing socialism. Once Soviet citizens expected no improvements from the future, nostalgia had to fill the vacuum left by utopia. Brezhnev replaced the promise of future perfection with a cult of Stalin and his leadership in the Second World War. The story of revolution was about the inevitable future. The memory of war was about the eternal past. This past had to be one of immaculate victimhood. It was taboo, indeed illegal, to mention that Stalin had begun the war as Hitler's ally. For a politics of inevitability to become a politics of eternity, the facts of history had to be sacrificed. The myth of the October Revolution promised everything. The myth of the Great Fatherland War promised nothing. The October Revolution foresaw an imaginary world in which all men would be brothers. To commemorate the Great Fatherland War was to evoke an eternal return of fascists from the West, who would always seek to destroy the Soviet Union or perhaps simply Russia. A politics of radical hope gave way to a politics of bottomless fear, which justified extraordinary expenditures on conventional and nuclear armaments. The great military parades of the Red Army on Red Square in Moscow were meant to demonstrate that the Soviet Union could not be changed. The men who ruled Russia in the 2010s were educated in this spirit. The same held for the actual deployment of the Red Army. It was to preserve the status quo in Europe. In the 1960s, some Czechoslovak communists believed that communism could be renewed. When the Soviet Union and its Warsaw Pact allies invaded Czechoslovakia to overthrow reform communists in 1968, Brezhnev spoke of fraternal assistance. According to the Brezhnev Doctrine, Soviet armies would halt any development in communist Europe that Moscow deemed threatening. The post-invasion regime in Czechoslovakia spoke of normalization, which nicely caught the spirit of the moment. What was normal. To say otherwise in Brezhnev's Soviet Union was to be condemned to an insane asylum. Brezhnev died in 1982. After two short interludes of rule by dying men, Mikhail Gorbachev came to power in 1985. Gorbachev believed that communism could be reformed and a better future promised. His main opponent was the party itself, in particular the ossified lobbies accustomed to the status quo. So Gorbachev tried to build new institutions to gain control over the party. He encouraged the communist leaders of the Soviet satellites in Eastern Europe to do the same. Polish communists, facing economic crisis and political opposition, took him at his word, scheduled partially free elections in 1989, and lost. This led to the creation of a non-communist Polish government and copycat revolutions throughout Eastern Europe. Within the Soviet Union, Gorbachev faced a similar challenge. The Soviet state, when constructed in 1922, had taken the form of a federation of national republics: Russia, Ukraine, Belarus, and so forth. To reform the state, as Gorbachev wished, meant enlivening the federal units. Democratic elections in the various Soviet republics were held in order to generate new elites who would implement economic reform. For example, elections held in the Russian Soviet Federative Socialist Republic in March 1990 created a new assembly, which chose Boris Yeltsin to be its chairman. Yeltsin was typical of new leaders produced by democracy, in that he believed that Russia had been ill-served by the Soviet Union. Societies of every Soviet republic believed that they had been exploited by the system to the benefit of other regions. The crisis came in summer 1991. Gorbachev's own legitimacy had come from the party, but he was trying to replace the party with a state. To do so, he had to find a formula that would both recognize the status of the republics and create a functional center in an atmosphere of nationalist discontent, political anxiety, and economic shortfall. His solution was a new union treaty, to be signed that August. A group of Soviet conservatives had Gorbachev arrested in his dacha on the night of August 18th during his vacation. They had little idea of what to do next, aside from broadcasting ballet on television. The victor of the coup proved to be Boris Yeltsin, who defied the plotters in Moscow, stood on a tank, and made himself a popular hero. Gorbachev was able to return to Moscow, but Yeltsin was now in charge. Once Yeltsin became its most important politician, the days of the Soviet Union were numbered. Western leaders feared instability and campaigned to keep the USSR intact. In August 1991, President George H.W. Bush traveled to Kiev to urge Ukrainians not to leave the Soviet Union. "Freedom is not the same as independence," he instructed them. In October, he told Gorbachev, "I hope you know the position of our government. We support the center." In December 1991, Yeltsin removed Russia from the Soviet Union by signing an agreement with newly elected leaders of Soviet Ukraine and Soviet Belarus. The Russian-Soviet Federative Socialist Republic of the Soviet Union became an independent state known as the Russian Federation. All of the other former republics of the Soviet Union followed suit. The new Russian Federation was established as a constitutional republic, legitimated by democracy, where a president and a parliament would be chosen by free elections. On paper, Russia had a succession principle. Ilin had anticipated a different transition from Soviet to Russian power: fascist dictatorship, the preservation of all Soviet territory, permanent war against the sinful West. Russians began to read him in the 1990s. His ideas had no effect on the end of the Soviet Union, but they did influence how post-Soviet oligarchs consolidated a new kind of authoritarianism in the 2000s and the 2010s. It is impossible for a human being to do what Ilin imagined a Russian redeemer should: emerge from a realm of fiction and act from the spirit of totality. Yet a feat of scenography by skilled propagandists, or, in the nice Russian phrase, political technologists, might create the appearance of such an earthly miracle. The myth of a redeemer would have to be founded on lies so enormous that they could not be doubted, because doubting them would mean doubting everything. It was not so much elections as fictions that allowed a transition of power, a decade after the end of the Soviet Union, from Boris Yeltsin to Vladimir Putin. Then Ilin and Putin rose together, the philosopher and the politician of fiction. Democracy never took hold in Russia, in the sense that power never changed hands after freely contested elections. Yeltsin was president of the Russian Federation because of an election that took place when Russia was still a Soviet republic in June 1991. Those taking part in that election were not choosing a president of an independent Russia, since no such thing yet existed. Yeltsin simply remained president after independence. To be sure, such an institutionally ambiguous claim to power was typical as the 1990s began. As the Soviet Empire in Eastern Europe and then the Soviet Union itself came apart, various backroom compromises, roundtable negotiations, and partly free elections generated hybrid systems of government. In other post-communist states, free and fair presidential and parliamentary elections quickly followed. The Russian Federation managed no election that might have legitimated Yeltsin or prepared the way for a successor. In the development Ilin had not foreseen, but which was easy to reconcile with his doctrine, the very rich chose Russia's redeemer. The wealthy few around Yeltsin, christened the oligarchs, wished to manage democracy in his favor and theirs. The end of Soviet economic planning created a violent rush for profitable industries and resources and inspired arbitrage schemes, quickly creating a new class of wealthy men. Wild privatization was not at all the same thing as a market economy, at least as conventionally understood. Markets require the rule of law, which was the most demanding aspect of the post-Soviet transformations. Americans, taking the rule of law for granted, could fantasize that markets would create the necessary institutions. This was an error. It mattered whether newly independent states established the rule of law, and above all whether they managed a legal transition of power through free elections. In 1993, Yeltsin dissolved the Russian parliament and sent armed men against its deputies. he told his Western partners that this was streamlining, needed to accelerate market reforms, a version of events accepted in the American press. So long as markets were invoked, politicians of inevitability could see an attack on a parliament as a step towards democracy. Yeltsin then used the conflict with parliament as a justification for strengthening the office of the president. In 1996, Yeltsin's team, by its own account, faked elections that won him another term as president. By 1999, Yeltsin was visibly ill and frequently intoxicated, and the problem of succession became acute. Elections were needed to replace him. From the perspective of the oligarchs, these needed to be managed and the outcome controlled. A successor was needed who would allow Yeltsin's family, in both the normal sense of his relatives and in the Russian sense of friendly oligarchs, to stay alive and maintain their wealth. Operation Successor, as the challenge was known in the Kremlin, had two stages: finding a man who was not a known associate of Yeltsin, and then inventing a fake problem that he could then appear to solve. To find a successor, Yeltsin's entourage organized a public opinion poll about favorite heroes in popular entertainment. The winner was Max Stierlitz, the hero of a series of Soviet novels that were adapted into a number of films, most famously the television serial 17 Moments of Spring in 1973. The fictional Stierlitz was a KGB plant in German military intelligence during the Second World War, a communist spy in Nazi uniform. Vladimir Putin, who had held a meaningless post in the East German provinces during his career in the KGB, was seen as the closest match to the fictional Stierlitz. Having enriched himself as the assistant to the mayor of St. Petersburg in the 1990s, Putin was known to the Kremlin and thought to be a team player. He had worked for Yeltsin in Moscow since 1998, chiefly as head of the Federal Security Service, FSB, the former KGB. When appointed Yeltsin's prime minister in August 1999, Putin was unknown to the larger public, so not a plausible candidate for national elected office. His approval rating stood at 2%. And so it was time to generate a crisis that he could appear to solve. In September 1999, a series of bombs exploded in Russian cities, killing hundreds of Russian citizens. It seemed possible that the perpetrators were FSB officers. In the city of Ryazan, for example, FSB officers were apprehended by their local colleagues as suspects in the bombings. Though the possibility of self-terrorism was noticed at the time, the factual questions were overwhelmed by righteous patriotism, as Putin ordered a new war against the part of Russia deemed to be responsible for the bombings, the Chechen Republic of southwestern Russia, in the Caucasus region, which had declared independence in 1993 and then fought the Russian army to a standstill. There was no evidence that Chechens had anything to do with the bombings. Thanks to the Second Chechen War, Putin's approval rating reached 45% in November. In December, Yeltsin announced his resignation and endorsed Putin as his successor. Thanks to unequal television coverage, manipulation of the vote tally, and the atmospherics of terrorism and war, Putin was accorded the absolute majority needed to win the presidential election of March 2000. The ink of political fiction is blood. So began a new kind of politics, known at the time as managed democracy, which Russians would master and later export. Credit for the political technology of Operation Successor was taken by Vladislav Surkov, a brilliant half-Chechen public relations specialist who served as Yeltsin's deputy chief of staff. The stage management of democracy that he pioneered, where a mysterious candidate used manufactured crises to assemble real power, continued as Surkov accepted a series of posts from Putin. During Putin's first two presidential terms, between 2000 and 2008, Surkov exploited manageable conflicts to gain popularity or change institutions. In 2002, after Russian security forces killed dozens of Russian civilians while retaking a theater from terrorists, television fell under total state control. After a provincial school was besieged by terrorists in 2004, the post of elected regional governor was abolished. Justifying the end of those elected governorships, Surkov, citing Ilin, claimed that Russians did not yet know how to vote, In Surkov's opinion, Russia was not ready and could not have been ready for life in the conditions of modern democracy. Nevertheless, Surkov continued, Russia was superior to other post-Soviet states in its sovereignty. He claimed that none of the non-Russian nations of the old Soviet Union was capable of statehood. Surkov's claims to Russian superiority did not pass a test that Russian leaders at the time still held to be relevant. Resemblance to, approval from, and rapprochement with Europe. In 2004, three former republics of the Soviet Union, Lithuania, Latvia, and Estonia, joined the European Union, along with several other East European states that had been Soviet satellites. In order to join the European Union, these countries had to demonstrate their sovereignty in specific ways that Russia had not, by creating a market that could bear competition, an administration that could implement EU law, and a democracy that held free and fair elections. States that joined the European Union had operative principles of succession. Russia did not. Surkov transformed this failure into a claim of superiority by speaking of sovereign democracy. In so doing, he conjured away Russia's problem that without actual democracy, or at least some succession principle, there was no reason to expect that Russia would endure as a sovereign state. Surkov suggested that sovereign democracy was a temporary measure that would allow Russia to find its own way to a certain kind of Western political society. Yet his term was celebrated by extreme nationalists, such as the fascist Alexander Dugin, who understood sovereign democracy as a permanent state of affairs, a politics of eternity. Any attempt to make of Russia an actual democracy could now be prevented, thought Dugin, by reference to sovereignty. Democracy is a procedure to change rulers. To qualify democracy with an adjective, people's democracy during communism, sovereign democracy thereafter, means eliminating that procedure. At first, Surkov gamely tried to have it both ways, claiming to have preserved the institution of democracy by bringing the right person to power. I would say that in our political culture, the personality is the institution. Ilin had performed the same trick. He called his redeemer a democratic dictator, since he supposedly represented the people. Surkov's pillars of Russian statehood were centralization, personification, and idealization. The state must be unified, its authority granted to an individual, and that individual glorified. Citing Ilin, Surkov concluded that the Russian people should have as much freedom as they were ready to have. Of course, what Ilin meant by freedom was the freedom of the individual to submerge himself in a collectivity that subjugates itself to a leader. Surkov's juggling act was possible in the prosperous first decade of the 21st century. Between 2000 and 2008, during Putin's first two terms as president, the Russian economy grew at an average rate of almost 7% per annum. Putin won his war in Chechnya. The government exploited high world market prices of natural gas and oil to distribute some export profits throughout the Russian population. The instability of the Yeltsin order had passed, and many Russians were understandably pleased and grateful. Russia also enjoyed a stable position in foreign affairs. Putin offered NATO Russia's support after the terrorist attacks of September 11, 2001. In 2002, he spoke favorably of European culture and avoided portraying NATO as an adversary. In 2004, Putin spoke in favor of European Union membership for Ukraine, saying that such an outcome would be in Russia's economic interest. He spoke of the enlargement of the European Union as extending a zone of peace and prosperity to Russia's borders. In 2008, he attended a NATO summit. In 2004, Putin was accorded the absolute majority necessary to win the office of president and begin a second four-year term. Fraudulent or not, regular elections at least assured Russians that there was a time limit for presidential power. Surely, Russians could imagine, in 2008 some new figure would emerge, as Putin had emerged in 2000. According to the Russian constitution, Putin could not legally run for a third term in 2008, and so instead chose his own successor, the unknown Dmitry Medvedev. Once Medvedev was accorded the office of president, he named Putin prime minister. Under Medvedev, the Russian constitution was changed so that the term of president was extended to 6 years. Putin would be permitted to run again in 2012 and again in 2018. This was clearly his intention. Victory of his party, United Russia, in the parliamentary elections of December 2011 and in all elections thereafter. Victory in the presidential elections of March 2012 and then again in March 2018. A total of 20 years in office, at least. The establishment of political eternity. Yet the only mechanism for returning to the office of president in 2012 was the apparently democratic election. Putin would have to cheat as before, but this time, when caught cheating, he would admit the deed. This was Surkov's identification of the personality with the institution, or Ilin's proposition of ritual elections. Because Putin had weakened the mechanism of succession, he would have to insist that Russia did not need one. Killing the political future forced the political present to be eternal. Making an eternity of the present required endless crisis and permanent threats. On December 4th, 2011, Russians were asked to grant United Russia a majority in the lower house of the Russian parliament. This was a special moment since Medvedev, then president, and Putin, then prime minister, had already announced that they intended to switch jobs. Once their party won the parliamentary elections, and once Putin won the presidential elections the coming March, Medvedev would serve Putin as prime minister. Many Russians found the prospect of eternal Putin unappealing. After the global financial collapse of 2008, Russian growth had slowed. Neither Putin nor Medvedev offered a program that would alter Russia's dependence upon commodity exports or offer the prospect of social mobility. Thus, many Russians saw these elections as the last chance to prevent stagnation and voted accordingly. By the reckonings of independent Russian electoral observers, United Russia won about 26% of the vote in the December 4 elections. The party was nevertheless accorded enough votes to control a majority in parliament. Russian and international observers criticized unbalanced media coverage and physical and digital manipulation of the vote. Nick Griffin, the leader of the British National Party and a Holocaust denier, was present as a regime-friendly observer. He declared the Russian elections much fairer than Britain's. On December 5th, the protests began. On December 10th, some 50,000 people gathered in Moscow. On December 24th, the figure grew to 80,000. Russians gathered in 99 cities over the course of the month, in the largest protests in the history of the Russian Federation. The main slogan was, "For free elections." The fakery was repeated during the March 4, 2012 presidential elections. Putin was accorded the majority that he needed to be named president after one round of balloting. This time, most of the electoral manipulation was digital rather than manual. Tens of millions of cyber votes were added, diluting the votes cast by human beings, and giving Putin a fictional majority. In some districts, Putin was accorded votes in round numbers, suggesting that targets set by central authorities had been understood literally by local officials. In Chechnya, Putin was accorded 99.8% of the ballots. The figure likely reflected the total control exercised by his Chechen ally, Ramzan Kadyrov. Putin received similar tallies in mental hospitals and other places subject to state control. In Novosibirsk, protesters complained that vote counts totaled 146% of the population. Once again, independent Russian and international observers noted the irregularities. And once again, regime-friendly foreigners from the far right endorsed the results. On March 5, 2012, in Moscow, some 25,000 Russian citizens protested the falsified presidential elections. For Putin himself, these months, between December 2011 and March 2012, were a time of choice. He might have listened to criticisms of the parliamentary vote. He might have accepted the outcome of the presidential ballot and won in the second round of voting rather than in the first. To win on the first ballot was a point of pride, nothing more. He might have understood that many of the protesters were concerned about the rule of law and the principle of succession in their country. Instead, he seemed to take personal offense. Putin chose to regard the transient illusion of winning on the first ballot as more important than law, and his own hurt feelings as more important than the convictions of his fellow citizens. Putin casually accepted that there had been fraud. Medvedev helpfully added that all Russian elections had been fraudulent. By dismissing the principle of one person, one vote, while insisting that elections would continue, Putin was disregarding the choices of citizens while expecting them to take part in future rituals of support. He thereby accepted Eline's attitude to democracy, rejecting what Eline had called blind faith in the number of votes and its political significance, not only in deed but in word. A claim to power was staked. He who fakes wins. If Putin came to the office of president in 2000 as a mysterious hero from the realm of fiction, he returned in 2012 as the vengeful destroyer of the rule of law. Putin's decision to steal the election under his own spotlight placed Russian statehood in limbo. His accession to the office of president in 2012 was therefore the beginning of a succession crisis. Since the man in power was also the man who had eliminated the future, the present had to be eternal. In 1999 and 2000, the Kremlin had used Chechens as the necessary enemy. Chechnya had now been defeated, and the Chechen warlord Kadyrov became an important member of Putin's regime. After the fakery of 2011 and 2012, the domestic political emergency was permanent, and so the enemy had to be as well. Some intractable foreign foe had to be linked to protesters so that they, rather than Putin himself, could be portrayed as a danger to Russian statehood. Protesters' actions had to be uncoupled from the very real domestic problem that Putin had created, and associated instead with a fake foreign threat to Russian sovereignty. The politics of eternity requires and produces problems that are insoluble because they are fictional. For Russia in 2012, the fictional problem became the designs of the European Union and the United States to destroy Russia. Leonid Brezhnev's permanent enemy, the decadent West, had returned, but this time, the decadence would be of a more explicitly sexual variety. Eline had described opposition to his views as sexual perversion, by which he meant homosexuality. A century later, this was also the Kremlin's first reaction to democratic opposition. Those who wished to have votes counted in 2011 and 2012 were not Russian citizens who wanted to see the law followed, their wishes respected, their state endure. They were mindless agents of global sexual decadence whose actions threatened the innocent national organism. On December 6, 2011, the day after the first protest in Moscow, the president of the Russian Federation, then still Dmitry Medvedev, retweeted a message to the effect that a leading protester was a stupid cocksucking sheep. Vladimir Putin, still prime minister but about to become president again, said on Russian television that the white ribbons worn by protesters made him think of condoms. Then he compared protesters to monkeys and did a monkey imitation. Visiting Germany, Putin told the surprised Angela Merkel that the Russian opposition was sexually deformed. Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov began to claim that the Russian government had to take a stand against homosexuality to defend the innocence of Russian society. A confidant of Putin, Vladimir Yakunin, developed the sheep image into a theory of geopolitics. In Yakunin's opinion, published in a long article in November 2012, Russia was eternally confronted with a conspiracy of enemies, which has controlled the course of history since time began. This global group had released homosexual propaganda around the world in order to reduce birth rates in Russia and thereby preserve the power of the West. The spread of gay rights was a deliberate policy intended to turn Russians into a herd easily manipulable by the global masters of capitalism. In September 2013, a Russian diplomat repeated this argument at a conference on human rights in China. Gay rights were nothing more than the chosen weapon of a global neoliberal conspiracy, meant to prepare virtuous traditional societies such as Russia and China for exploitation. President Putin took the next step at his personal global summit at Valdai a few days later, comparing same-sex partnerships to Satanism. He associated gay rights with a Western model that opens a direct path to degradation and primitivism, resulting in a profound demographic and moral crisis. The Russian parliament had by then passed a law, for the purpose of protecting children from information advocating for denial of traditional family values. Human sexuality is an inexhaustible raw material for the manufacture of anxiety. The attempt to place heterosexuality within Russia and homosexuality beyond was factually ludicrous, but the facts are beside the point. The purpose